Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241, and it's March 1st. I think the schedule of your labs, the date is wrong. I think I have February 29th for today, for the lab schedule, but you all know it's probably, there's no such thing as March 29th this year, right? Okay, so it's March 1st. And I do want to talk to one student that had a question about the action potential who was in Dr. Spooner's or Professor Spooner's lab. And I don't recall your name, and I can't say it out loud anyway because I'm recording the lecture, all right? So make sure you see me right after class, okay? And you didn't send me an email, but you sent me a nice note, and I don't have that note in front of me, so make sure you contact me after class. All right, so we're going to finish up metabolism and then move on to nervous system. So let's see. Here we have the same slide on both projectors. And what is the point of all this metabolism that we have been learning about? All right, that's not on this particular slide, but you got to draw it in. All right, as a matter of fact, I kind of gave you a hint. You know, what's the purpose of metabolism? Is it to produce lactic acid? Is it to consume glucose? Is it to produce CO2 or water? What's the whole purpose of all of this? Don't lose the main focus, which is to produce ATP, right? So you want to be aware of which processes produce how much ATP, at least in a ballpark, all right? And you do have to know some of the little complicating issues, but not too much detail. Like, you don't need to know everything about glycolysis, all right? But you should at least know that glucose goes to pyruvate, something about glycolysis. It splits glucose in half. And in so doing, what does it give the cell? How many ATPs are produced by glycolysis? Two, but that's not the only thing. What else does glycolysis produce that will eventually end up producing a lot of ATP? NADH, right? Okay. And then that NADH is imported into the mitochondria at a little bit of cost. It gets converted to FADH2, right? So you lose a little bit of ability to make ATP, but not too bad. All right. But under what conditions can that NADH enter mitochondria and pyruvic acid enter mitochondria? Only specific conditions. Under aerobic conditions. If not, then pyruvic acid is converted to lactic acid, and that NADH is used up, it's converted back to NAD, and so this anaerobic pathway can produce how many ATPs? Just two for every glucose molecule, right? All right, so, but if oxygen is present, then it can enter into mitochondria, and it can be completely broken down into CO2 and water. Of course, what else do you need in order to get this process working? And the hint is, right, if you're thinking the way I was, it requires oxygen for that to happen. All right, so there is a preparatory reaction that is signified by this little arrow right here. All right, so pyruvic enter is at the top of this arrow. What's at the bottom of this little arrow? I call that the preparatory reaction to the Krebs cycle. It's a reaction that really precedes the Krebs cycle. This converts, it's a decarboxylation step, so it takes one carbon off of pyruvic acid. And so how many carbons are in pyruvic acid? There are three, so if we take one carbon off, you're left with two. What's the name of that two-carbon fragment? It's an acetyl group, all right? But it doesn't float around inside the cell by itself as an acetyl group. It's bound to something. It's bound to a coenzyme that carries it around, because that's the job of a coenzyme. It carries something around inside the cell. And what's the name of that coenzyme? I'll give you a hint. It was like one of the first ones. Coenzyme, you could say one, but it's really coenzyme A, right? So that's why when we have an acetyl group bound to coenzyme A, it's called acetyl coenzyme A, right? And it carries that two-carbon fragment into the Krebs cycle, but it also produces something beneficial for us, this preparatory reaction. That energy, as a result of that decarboxylation, produces a high-energy intermediate, which is what? Anybody remember what that is? It produces another NADH for every pyruvic acid. And how many pyruvic acids do you get from glucose?
Two.
You get two, right? So you get two NADHs produced by that preparatory reaction. And then where do those NADHs go? So we're going to sidestep Krebs, get back to that in just a second. Where does that NADH go? Yeah, it goes to electron transport chain. So every NADH inside the mitochondria, how many ATP can you make? And I just want to know the theoretical maximum, not under special kinds of conditions where it's always going to be three. going to be 3 ATPs for every NADH. But for every glucose, 2 acetyl-CoAs are made, so you got 6 ATPs for every glucose that are being made by this preparatory reaction. All right, so does that kind of fit the general scheme of this slide right here? Because what are we interested in? How much ATP is produced by each of these metabolic pathways. All right, so also remember that making ATP from ADP and inorganic phosphate is what kind of thermodynamic reaction? Is it endergonic or exergonic? Making ATP is endergonic. So in order to make ATP, what does that reaction have to be coupled with? Exergonic reactions. And so what we have right here are what? A series of exergonic metabolic pathways that are all geared into making ATP, right? So it's taking the energy and chemical bonds and funneling it into the chemical energy that is in ATP, one way or the other. All right, so how many ATPs can the Krebs cycle make for every acetyl-CoA that enters? I wrote it on the board last time, so I don't want to go over it again. So remember, it makes 1 ATP by substrate level phosphorylation, but it also makes some other high energy intermediates like FADH2, NADH. How many NADHs are made by Krebs cycle for one turn? 3. How many FADH2s?
1.
Just one? Okay, yeah, just one. So review that a little bit. So that's the level that I want you to know glycolysis and Krebs cycle at, right? I don't want you to know all the intermediates, but I want you to know the high energy compounds that come out of it. What else is interesting about the Krebs cycle with regard to this compound right here that I'm pointing at? Does Krebs cycle produce any CO2? And what do you do with CO2? You breathe it out of your body. What about Krebs cycle and CO2? I think you're going to have to maybe study that a little bit in your chapter and review this lecture again, right? Because I want you to be able to talk about these metabolic pathways and answer some of these questions like you're familiar with it. All right, so there, one decarboxylation happens in this preparatory reaction that produces a CO2, and the other two decarboxylations happens in the Krebs cycle. So Krebs cycle produces 2 CO2s. So let's count that up. 2 CO2s from Krebs cycle, 1 from the preparatory reaction. That accounts for all the carbons that were in pyruvic acid that entered the mitochondria. So basically, glucose has been broken down entirely into CO2 and water. Right, and the energy in those chemical bonds that was released because these are exergonic reactions then get used, that energy gets used to make ATP, right, which is an endergonic reaction. All right, so the question was, Krebs cycle right here, how many ATPs are made if we account for all the NADH and FADHs? I think I had it on the board over here. 12, I like that. Okay, I want you just to kind of remember that because we're going to use that as a ballpark figure, okay? How much ATP is produced just by the Krebs cycle. All right, so let's just review. The purpose of this is to make ATP. Glycolysis, all right, when it's under anaerobic conditions, produces how many ATP? A measly 2. That might be better than nothing. Can't maintain consciousness, but it might keep somebody's brain alive for a little while, right? Might keep a muscle alive as long as it's not contracting. All right, maybe what's an important muscle that you would like to keep alive? Your heart. Unfortunately, with the heart, can you ever get it to stop contracting? No, it's always going to be using up a lot of ATP, unless you're in a hospital and somebody deliberately stops it and it puts it in kind of a safe mode for a while because it's not using up a lot of energy if it's not contracting. But if a heart is contracting, it will deplete ATP very fast, and of course, then it will die a lot faster as a result of that. There's another condition that a heart can be in. Usually a heart contracts in a very nice controlled fashion, rhythmically. We call it a normal sinus rhythm when it contracts, right? Systole, then diastole, systole and diastole. But there's another condition where it uses up even more energy, and that's when it goes into fibrillation and the whole heart contracts uncoordinated manner, but it's contracting all the time during fibrillation and it burns up a lot of ATP very rapidly. It's not pumping blood. So the heart is not getting oxygen, so that's a very serious condition. Does anybody know what kind of devices that, I don't think we have any here, maybe there's some on campus, but the fire station has them, Disneyland has them, and it can help somebody who is in ventricular fibrillation. Anybody have any? I'm sure some of you have had training on this particular device. Yeah, an automatic electronic defibrillator, right? And it's a really nice device because it can take you out of that fibrillation, get you back to a normal sinus rhythm where the heart is, number one, pumping blood, but and it's not burning up as much energy. So that protects the heart in a couple of different ways. Okay. So Krebs cycle, 12 ATP for every turn, as long as you take into account the NADH that's produced as well. All right, so let me flip through some of these slides right here. You should be going over these. Make sure you know the difference between glycogenolysis, gluconeogenesis, right? What else? Glycolysis, this lactate dehydrogenase pathway right here. All right, and what is this pathway that can take lactic acid or pyruvic acid or other three-carbon intermediates like maybe glycerol and convert it into glucose? I didn't mention that one yet. That's the fourth pathway. Making glucose is what? Making of new glucose. There's a hint. Gluconeogenesis is this pathway coming up over here, right? From pyruvic acid back to glucose. Okay, so make sure you know the up arrow and down arrow over here with glycogen, the up arrow and the down arrow over here and here from glucose 6-phosphate. Okay, then the last concept, which is a little strange, but maybe you reviewed since our last lecture, is this chemiosmotic theory. And this is how high-energy electrons that are trapped in NADH and FADH2, how they are used to make ATP. And so you should know, on this slide that we were just talking about over here, make sure you know what cellular compartment these different processes are taking place in. Like glycolysis, where does that happen? In the cytosol. And Krebs cycle is always in the mitochondria, inside the matrix of the mitochondria. Electron transport, where is that at? Okay, it's in mitochondria, but even be a little bit more specific. What part of the mitochondria? The Christi membrane, right? The Christi membrane. So when you guys get together and study, go ahead and quiz each other on all those really cool things. So here we are on this PowerPoint slide on the Christi membrane, right? And so NADH, FADH2 within the matrix of the mitochondria release these electrons and can reduce these proteins. And as electrons then flow out of these proteins into other compounds that will become reduced, so when this pump here becomes oxidized, when an electron flows out of it, it can pump protons from low concentration to high. All right, so what kind of transport is that? When something goes from low concentration to high, that's active transport. It needs energy, right? And that energy is received from the flow of these electrons through the electron transport chain. And there are three of these pumps, right? So that helps you remember for every NADH, how many ATP can be produced? 1, 2, 3. All right, that's kind of a loose analogy, but that might help you understand. FADH, does it release electrons to this first pump, but somewhere before this second pump? So FADH can produce 2 ATPs. But now how is ATP really produced? What is contained in this gradient of protons from the intermembrane space where it's high to the matrix where it's low? What is really in that concentration gradient? Okay, what's really in it's an entity, it's a physical entity, but it's hard to place your finger on it. It's hard to hold. Protons you could hold. You could have a beaker of protons someplace. It is, or electrons. You could have a beaker of electrons someplace. Okay, that entity is energy. That entity is energy. So there's energy in this gradient right here. And protons want to flow back down into the matrix. And in so doing, here's another really nifty protein embedded in the Christi membrane. It allows protons to flow through it, but it will take that energy as protons flow down, and it will then phosphorylate ADP with inorganic phosphate, making ATP out of it. So remember, what is this reaction right here? ADP plus inorganic phosphate making ATP. Endergonic or exergonic? It's endergonic. It needs energy. In order for it to work, where does it get the energy from? This flow of protons down the concentration gradient, right? So there is energy in this proton gradient. This protein knows how to harness it. And this process right here is dependent on oxygen that we see. These electrons have to flow in oxygen. So this last step in phosphorylating ADP typically is what we call what kind of phosphorylation? Since it's dependent on oxygen right here? Oxidative phosphorylation, which is a different kind of phosphorylation than substrate level phosphorylation. All right, so if we look on this slide back over here on the right, where do we have substrate level phosphorylation taking place? Krebs cycle has one step, but where else? Also, glycolysis has two steps, actually four steps of substrate level phosphorylation, but don't forget, in order to get glycolysis working, what do you have to spend to get it to work? You got to spend some ATP, right? You got to spend two ATP to get it to work. Glycolysis makes four, but you got to repay the two ATP that was necessary to get glycolysis working, so the net reaction is only worth two ATP for you. Okay. All right, so now I think we're kind of ready to write some important bullet points down on this metabolism that we see over here. All right, anaerobic metabolism produces, you already told me, two ATP for every glucose. All right, but now if you take a glucose and let it run all the way through aerobic respiration, how many ATP can you make? Okay. Yeah, and your book cites different sources depending on the conditions of the cell and whether it's theoretical or the maximum yield. It's going to be 30-something. Right, so that's the important point that I want you to compare in your mind. Anaerobic respiration is 2. Aerobic respiration, breaking glucose all the way down to CO2 and water, is 30-something ATP, right? Depending on conditions. So if you're in that ballpark, that's great for me. Now, pay attention to your lab instructors. They might be really particular. They might want you to know 32, 34, 33 and 3/4. I don't care what they say, right? But make sure that you know what your lab instructors expect of you, okay? All right, for me, 30-something on a test. All right, that's for what the initial substrate? That is? Where is this energy coming from to make that ATP? I'm kind of giving you a hint with the cursor on this slide. For every glucose molecule. Okay, for every glucose molecule. All right, so we need to turn our attention a little bit to some other substrates that your body can use to make ATP. All right. Don't forget the importance of this oxygen right here, because without oxygen, what happens to the electron transport chain? It stops, right? And then none of these protons get pumped. Nothing can flow back through this ATP synthase or synthetase, and then ATP cannot be made. Okay. And you should know the difference between substrate level and oxidative phosphorylation. All right, so that's, I think, all of these slides right here. This slide right here is a pretty nice synopsis. You should be familiar with that. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about fat metabolism right now. So we're going to change our review to pressing on with some new information. All right, fats, what the heck is a fat before we go on? What is a fat? Give me an example of a fat. Triglyceride is exactly what I was thinking of. You could have maybe given me some other examples, like maybe prostaglandins or things like that, steroids, right? But let's focus our attention on triglycerides. All right, so a triglyceride, as a matter of fact, cross off fat right here and actually say triglyceride, because you guys are at that level right now. Triglyceride can be hydrolyzed, right, to its basic building blocks, which is what? Three fatty acids and a glycerol. Okay, and the enzyme that will do that is called a lipase, L-I-P-A-S-E. All right, and then the fatty acids can be modified to run through the Krebs cycle. And as things get run through the Krebs cycle, how many ATPs can be generated every time a Krebs cycle goes around one turn? 12, that's right. That's what we agreed on. All right, and as a matter of fact, what is the thing that enters the Krebs cycle? How many carbon units long? It's actually two. It's an acetyl group, right? Pyruvate enters the mitochondria, but before that pyruvate can enter the Krebs cycle, it has to be decarboxylated by that preparatory reaction, right? One decarboxylation, then you have two carbons left, and then that can enter the Krebs cycle. So that's what we have to do with fatty acids to get it to go through the Krebs cycle. We have to chew up a fatty acid. How many carbon units at a time to get it to go through Krebs cycle? Two carbon units at a time, because that's what enters a Krebs cycle. Okay? All right, proteins can be broken down. We're not going to spend much time with proteins in here, but proteins have an amino group, and that amino group has to be taken off. We call that deamination, and then those different fragments from amino acids can run through the Krebs cycle. For every turn of the Krebs cycle, how many ATPs can you make? You can make 12, right? But that amino group is very toxic, and you have to get rid of it out of your body. That's one of the jobs of your kidney, to get rid of urea. That ammonia gets converted to urea, and then we can eliminate it from our bodies. But we want to focus on fats. That's what we have time for in this class. All right, so some of these pathways can interconvert carbohydrates and proteins into carbohydrates, and carbohydrates and proteins into fats. But once something is a fat, it's stuck. It can't be converted back to a carbohydrate, can't be converted back to a protein. Okay. And that's because in order to make a fatty acid, it can either be degraded as a two-carbon unit or it can be built as from two-carbon units. Carbohydrates have, what, 3, 4, 5, or 6 carbons added together, which is not the same kind of language that a fat is made out of. A fat is made out of two-carbon fragments, and proteins, various kinds of carbon units. Okay, so here is a pretty nice illustration of something, and I want you to label some of these pathways. So here we have glucose, right? Here we got glucose. Here we got glycogen. Of course, you can convert glycogen to glucose or glucose into glycogen, and you should be familiar with those pathways, the name of them anyway. We're going to look in a lot more detail later on in the class of these pathways right here. Here we have fat, which is another important energy molecule. Because fat can be broken down, or triglycerides. Cross that fat off. I have a hard time saying it. Put triglycerides. And triglycerides can be broken down to these building blocks right here. Glycerol has 3 carbons, so guess what it can do? It can enter glycolysis, right? And it can either go up to make glucose or go down to make pyruvic acid. And then that pyruvic acid can be used to make ATP via the Krebs cycle right here. These fatty acids, though, are broken down only 2 carbons at a time. And because of that, can never enter glycolysis or gluconeogenesis. All right, once something is a 2-carbon fragment, it becomes an acetyl group, and the only fate for this acetyl group is to enter the Krebs cycle, or maybe it can be restored as a fatty acid. So this pathway from triglyceride to these building blocks right here, what enzyme would you put here? It's not even a metabolic pathway. It's just an enzyme. It is lipase, right? I'm belaboring that point because it's a question on your internet questions, okay? One or the other. All right, now this process of going from fatty acids, now do you have a picture in your mind of what a fatty acid looks like? Little molecule or a big molecule? Big, long, stringy molecule of hydrocarbons, right? Carbon, 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 carbon with hydrogens coming off the sides of them. All right, many carbons long. It can be broken down 2 carbons at a time to form this acetyl group, which you don't want to throw away, because what can you make out of this acetyl group? If it goes into mitochondria, what? A lot of ATP, 12, right? Exactly, for every turn right here. So this process where you take fatty acids converted into acetyl-CoA is what we call beta oxidation. So some organs are really fantastic at breaking fatty acids down via beta oxidation into acetyl-CoA, and then what do you do with that acetyl-CoA? Make a glob of ATP out of each one of them. Okay? So fat is a very important storage form of energy. So these arrows right here, you want to say lipase. This dotted arrow right here, you want to say beta oxidation. All right, so we need to look at beta oxidation a little bit. That's where we're heading with this discussion. Okay, maybe I'll come back to this slide, maybe not. All right, fat synthesis. Oh, let's go back to here. Come on, we can go back one. Thank you. All right, so the dotted line is lipase. All right, the enzyme. This solid line right here, that is what? Lipogenesis. The making of triglycerides. Okay, so fatty acids and glycerol, that makes the triglycerides right here. Occurs mainly in adipose tissue and liver tissues. All right, so if there is an abundance of energy or an abundance of 2-carbon fragments, the liver will make a lot of fat. Okay, and fat is the major energy storage form in the body. Let's just look at the energy yield of fat versus carbohydrate. In fat, if we take a gram, there are about 9 kilocalories, or in terms of dietary calories, that's a large calorie with a capital C. All right, 9 versus for a gram of carbohydrate, there's only 4. So if you want to store energy in your body, right, and it's going to cost you some energy to carry it around in a suitcase, right? It's going to cost you energy. How would you like to store that energy? In something that is light or heavy? Okay, yeah, something that's light. So you have a lot more energy stored in fat compared to a carbohydrate. So it's a very efficient way of storing energy inside your body. All right, so let's see if we can figure out how we get energy out of fat. Well, there's lipolysis, right? Lipolysis uses lipase. That's just breaking triglycerides down into fatty acids and glycerol. All right, and then those fatty acids are broken down into acetyl-CoA via beta oxidation. So this is the scheme that I want you to become aware of a little bit. So here we, and I can't make this slide any bigger, unfortunately, but here we have a really long fatty acid. All right, this could have 18 carbon atoms, or could have 16, all right? But we're only drawing the last 3 right here. And fatty acid, how do we know this is a fatty acid? What do we have right here? Our carboxylic group, which is what? An acid group. All right, and it's a nice functional group. It makes this end of the fatty acid fairly reactive. We can start to do some chemistry with this. So here's the first carbon from the carboxyl group. Here's the second one. So this is the alpha. Here's the beta carbon. Instead of putting 1 and 2, you use alpha and beta. And guess what? We're going to be operating on this carbon right here. Therefore, we call that beta oxidation because we're working on this carbon right here. To get beta oxidation started, it requires, we're going to take these two carbons and attach it to a coenzyme A, which is a typical kind of scheme that you're aware of. It requires some ATP to get this process started. All right, so now we have coenzyme A bound to a fatty acid, and then through some rearrangements and transfers of electrons, which we're not going to be too particular in this class, we see that we can now capture some of those high energy electrons, and beta oxidation, the step of chopping off these two carbon units right here, produces one FADH and one NADH. And beta oxidation happens inside the matrix of the mitochondria, not the cytoplasm. All right, so what did we agree on? What's the yield of ATP for every FADH2 in the matrix of a mitochondria? On this slide, I see 1.5, so that's like a practical limit, but I always want you to work in the theoretical maximum. It's going to be 2. Okay, and for every NADH that's in the matrix of a mitochondria, again, here we see some actual yield, but I want you to always work in the theoretical maximum yield. That's going to be 3. All right, so just beta oxidation produces 5 ATP for every one of these steps. All right, so how many times will beta oxidation take place, for instance, if this is a 16-carbon fatty acid? If it's 16, you could say, oh, maybe 8, but it's really 7, because the last time, what do you produce? The last time you actually produce two carbon fragments, right? If you have a 4-carbon fragment and you break it in half, that very last step, you've got 2. So it only goes through beta oxidation 7 times, not really 8 times. All right, so that's the multiplier you would want to use. All right, but now, what's the end result of beta oxidation? You've got acetyl-CoA, which is what? These two carbons bound to coenzyme A. And what could happen with this acetyl-CoA? It can enter the Krebs cycle, and for every turn of the Krebs cycle, how many ATPs do you get? As we said on the board over here, 12. This is, right, some practical, not the theoretical maximum, but let's just say 12. All right, so if you add up all of the ATP that's produced by beta oxidation with a typical kind of fatty acid and all the 8 2-carbon fragments that can enter the Krebs cycle, now let's compare the energy yield in ATP for a fatty acid compared to glucose. What do you think is more? What was glucose? How many, for every glucose, how many ATP can you make through aerobic respiration? 30-something. Good ballpark. Now what about for a typical kind of fatty acid? Right? It's over 100. All right, so fatty acids are even a better energy source, and some organs really like to burn fatty acids more than glucose. I believe the heart is one of those organs. All right, you probably have some examples in your book where you have to calculate it exactly, and just try to use the theoretical maximum that keeps it simple for everybody. Right, so that's the ballpark information that I would like for you to know. Anaerobic, 2 ATPs for glucose. Aerobic for glucose, 30-something. Fatty acid, all right, is over 100. Okay, now, under what conditions does beta-oxidation work? Where is beta-oxidation taking place? In the matrix of the mitochondria. In order for, okay, anything inside the mitochondria to work, what does it need? It needs oxygen, right? So beta oxidation is dependent on oxygen being present as well. Okay, so your body cannot rely on beta oxidation when it is ischemic or when it is low on oxygen. Right? So it doesn't have aerobic respiration at all, and it doesn't have beta oxidation to make ATP. Only what? Only glycolysis under these anaerobic conditions. Oh, that's the very last slide. All right, so let me just go back to this one right here. All right, so how many carbons are in acetyl-CoA? There's only two. Okay, so acetyl-CoA, as a result, cannot be used to make glucose. I don't have a slide I can get to quickly on that, but if you look at your glycolysis slide, or maybe a slide before that, we don't see any up arrows between acetyl-CoA and pyruvic acid. All right, but you need to have at least three carbons to make glucose, not an acetyl group. All right, so the possible fates of acetyl-CoA. It can be used to make fatty acids, two carbons at a time. Okay, so you can store that energy. You can harvest some of this energy and make ATP out of it through the Krebs cycle. It can be used to make cholesterol, but that's like making more fatty acids, making a lipid. All right, but let's consider this. There is a diet that some people, a couple years ago, that people really liked, okay? And it was called, what was it called? Ah, that's it, thank you. It was a high-fat, low-carbohydrate, okay, kind of diet. And these Krebs cycle intermediates right here, all right, are all based on sugar molecules. They're 4-carbon, 5-carbon, 6-carbon kinds of units. None of them are 2-carbon. The only 2-carbon is acetyl-A coming into the Krebs cycle. So in order for your body to use acetyl-coenzyme A, you have to have some carbohydrate in your diet to make sure that the Krebs cycle is operating. All right. So if somebody is on a strict Atkins diet or one that they're not particularly paying attention to, all right, the Krebs cycle shuts down because these are all sugar-based molecules. All right, so if you don't have any sugar in your body and you want to make ATP, you don't have any glucose and you want to make ATP, what does your body refer to make ATP? Okay, it tries to make ATP from beta oxidation. Okay, so it will break lipids down in your body, even though you have a high lipid content in your diet. It will break lipids down into acetyl-CoA, but because the Krebs cycle isn't open, all right, this pathway is shut down. All right, but nonetheless, your body is starving for energy. It wants to make ATP, so it keeps breaking down fatty acids. And as a result of it, the only thing that your body can do is make these ketone bodies. It will take 2 carbons and put them together to make a 4-carbon unit. Okay, and one of those things is, one of the ketones bodies is called acetone. Maybe some of you might be familiar with acetone. And if I were to pour some acetone, where can you find acetone? In a hardware store or a beauty shop or something? What is acetone used for? Like fingernail polish remover, right? So if we take some fingernail polish remover and pour it on the table right here, what's going to happen to it? Is it will sit there like overnight or what? It will evaporate very fast, right? Acetone evaporates into the air very, very fast. Okay, so these ketone bodies then, you just breathe right out of your body as a result. Okay, and you can smell them on somebody's breath, for instance, if they're on an Atkins diet. So that's why it is really pretty marvelous, because it will take lipids, and instead of having to run a marathon to get rid of that energy that you have stored in your body as lipid, what are you doing with it? You're converting it to acetone, and you're just breathing it out of your body. A marvelous kind of diet, right? It is really, really marvelous. Are you kind of following what I'm saying? Okay, so you don't have to exercise, a great diet, but what's the trade-off? Let's go over to this slide right here. If because you don't have carbohydrates in your diet and you turn off the Krebs cycle, what's the downside? Well, you're not making any ATP, right? Sure, you're losing weight, that's great, but you're not making ATP, and what does your brain need a lot of? ATP. Exactly right. So, I've known a lot of people to be on an Atkins diet and follow it to an extreme, really cut out carbohydrates in their diet, and they get really dingy. They can't even remember what side of the road they're driving on. They couldn't care less what color the stoplight is, right? Because their brain is being starved for ATP. So it's kind of dangerous, all right? But since they're a low glucose, right, since they're low glucose, they don't have glucose in their body. Glucose is not getting inside the cell. There's another condition where glucose cannot enter the cell. And you're all very familiar with it. At the end of the class, you'll be able to answer that question, right? As a matter of fact, there's high glucose in the blood, but because glucose can't get into the cell, all the cells in their body are starving to death because they can't get glucose, and that is diabetes mellitus, right? So when you're on an Atkins diet, it's producing an artificial kind of diabetes mellitus in your cells as a result of that. So you've got to be really careful when you follow some of these strange kinds of diets. And of course, the more you know about biochemistry, the more it becomes obvious that it's really important for you to, if you're going to do something like that, follow it with maybe the advice of a professional dietitian or a physician that knows some of these details. Okay, and that's because why? This 2-carbon unit can't be used when you're on that Atkins diet to convert it into that energy in acetyl-CoA, can't be used to make ATP, and that acetyl-CoA can't be used to make sugar molecules, right? You don't see acetyl-CoA being used to make any kind of sugar, which is necessary to make this Krebs cycle work. You need sugar molecules to do the Krebs cycle, and if you read all the details and fine print in an Atkins diet, it says, after so many days, what do you have to have? You have to reintroduce some carbohydrates into your diet, otherwise you will kill yourself, all right, because the Krebs cycle shuts down as a result of that. Okay. All right, this has some other interesting implications for another kind of molecule. I think I wrote on the board maybe last time or time before, and that was ethyl alcohol. How many carbon units are in ethyl alcohol? There's 2, okay? And so what are the possible fates of ethyl alcohol? Here's acetyl-CoA, right? It can be oxidized to make acetyl-coenzyme A. And with ethyl alcohol, what are the possibilities? Convert it into ATP with a Krebs cycle, or you can make fat out of it, right? And those are the only possible 2 fates for alcohol. So when you drink a lot of alcohol, what is that eating basically? It's basically just eating fat, okay? In a liquid form, because that's the only possible fate, and that happens in the liver. So what happens to the liver when you drink a lot of alcohol? Converts it into fat, you end up with a fatty liver, and what happens to a fatty liver? Probably we're not too familiar with that. Okay, leads to liver cirrhosis, which means you have a dead liver, but you can't really live without a liver, so then you need a liver transplant, or when you stress a liver like that, it will turn cancerous. All right, so there's some really nasty consequences to, I've known people to just basically kill themselves by having 3 beers every day for a long period of time. All right, so you cannot have a steady diet, even though you might think it's just a moderate diet of alcohol. Okay, so you athletes have to watch out too. But at least, you athletes, what are you athletes doing? You're using this Krebs cycle a lot, right, to produce ATP. So exercise certainly protects you from certain things like that. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. So I'll have to stop and maybe ask you some questions. Who's got questions about what you have to know and the interrelationships of some of these things, right? So where does beta oxidation funnel its intermediates so that you can even get more ATPs from it? beta oxidation, let's see, where's beta oxidation at? Here's beta oxidation. It funnels its intermediates into the Krebs cycle, right? And then with oxidative phosphorylation, we can make a lot of ATP, right? And on the board, we calculated 12. Your book calculates it a little bit differently, okay? All right, so that's the last thing. So you're not responsible, unless you have an end of chapter question on amino acids, we're not going to cover amino acids. All right, so that's it for that chapter. And I don't see any hands raised for questions. All right, but if you want to ask me anytime question on metabolism before the next test, you're welcome to do that, because you might not have any right on the tip of your tongue right at the moment. I got a feeling you're still maybe thinking about some of these things. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it has, in order to make a peptide bond, there has to be an amino group for that, for the dehydration reaction to occur to make a very strong peptide bond between amino acids. And when proteins are broken down to amino acids and you want to degrade an amino acid further, that amino group has to be taken off and it becomes ammonia. Okay, and that ammonia is very toxic. And so then your body, your liver has to convert ammonia to urea, which then your kidney can excrete from your body. Okay, so it's that amino group that's necessary to make a very strong peptide bond. But when we start to break it down, break proteins down to amino acids, and break amino acids further down into basic building blocks, that amino group has to be taken off, and that's called a deamination. And the product is very toxic in your body. Ammonia is very toxic. Okay, if we're a fish, it's not so bad. Because ammonia then will just diffuse right out of your body into the water. But when we make ammonia, it has no place to go, right? It can't just go into the water. So it has to be converted into a substance that your kidney can put in urine so that we can excrete it that way. Okay. All right, so we're kind of done with chapter 5, so we're going to move on to chapter 7, nervous system. This might be the longest chapter, maybe the most challenging chapter in the class. I'm not really so sure. Okay, I think we've talked about some of these things already. So some of it is review. If you're not familiar with diffusion, right, make sure you go back and active transport. Make sure you go back and understand some of those concepts. You got really good videos in Blackboard to review those things. So a lot of the first part of this chapter is just a review from anatomy, so I get to go over it pretty fast. So remember, the nervous system can be broken down into two major divisions, which is central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And the central nervous system, furthermore, is made out of the brain and spinal cord. Peripheral nervous system is nervous tissue everywhere outside the central nervous system. So that includes peripheral nerves. And you got two kinds of peripheral nerves. Depending on their origin, some peripheral nerves come from the brain and brain stem. We call those cranial nerves. Other nerves arise from the spinal cord, so we call those spinal nerves, right? So that's a nice, easy way. Okay. If we look at nervous tissue, as a matter of fact, how many different kinds of tissues are there in your body? If we're going to break it down into major categories. There's four. What are they? You got epithelium, I like. Connective tissue and muscle. And nervous tissue, right? So there's only four kinds, three different major kinds of muscle. And as far as nervous tissue is concerned, there are two major types of cells. There are cells that carry electrical information very fast over long distances in your body. We call those neurons. And then there are cells that help the neurons do their job. And we call those neuroglia cells, or glial cells, or support cells. They don't carry electrical information, but they just help those neurons do their job. So a lot of people think neurons are the functional units of the nervous system. Yeah, and I kind of like that. That's okay. But you know what? I think people are becoming more and more interested in glial cells now than nervous system cells, because the glial cells tell the neurons how to connect up with each other. All right, so it's not so important that you have a wire. What's really important if you're hooking up a phone system? It's not so important that you walk into your house that you have a wire, but it's real important that you know how to hook the wire up, right? Okay, and that's what the glial cells do. All right, so the glial cells really help maintain homeostasis of the nervous system, so you have many more of them than you have neurons. All right, so we're going to have to maybe look in some more detail of these different kinds of cells. So neurons, they gather information and they transmit information. Different parts of a neuron do different things. One part gathers, the other part transmits. So not only does it gather information, but it integrates information. It gathers and integrates information. So as a result, neurons can respond to stimuli. They can make decisions for us, right? And then after a decision is made, it sends that decision out through some kind of, an efferent pathway to effect some change in your body. All right, so neurons produce and send electrochemical impulses, and when that electrochemical impulse reaches the end of a neuron, it releases chemical messengers so that it can transmit that information to another cell. All right, so did we understand what that functional and structural unit of communication between cells is called? It's a synapse, right? So that's what we're talking about here. All right, so there's a synapse that releases chemical messages to another cell. So what kind of synapse is that? Is that electrical or chemical? That's a chemical synapse, right? And that chemical typically we call a neurotransmitter. And then we're going to learn the names of some particular neurotransmitters. All right, so here are some neurons. And you should know what the function of these different shapes of neurons are. But the basic neuron has a central location with a lot of cytoplasm, including the nucleus. This is what we call the cell body. And it runs around with another name sometimes, depending on the group of people you're hanging out with. And it could be called the soma, right? So the soma just means body. And then these small projections right here are called dendrites. This is the receiving end of the neuron. It receives signals. These signals flow then through all of these neurons over the cell body. And the signals then kind of converge. You see a little funnel right here? It converges on this axon hillock. So this is the integration center of a neuron, and it makes a decision on what to do, and then it sends the decision down an axon, which is a very long projection. This could be meters long. These dendrites are very short, right? They're microscopic, but an axon, you can't see it because it's microscopically thin, but it's really long. Okay, it could be a couple centimeters long or a couple feet or maybe even a meter long in some people. Right, and that information, as you see, flows down the axon. And what about the direction of that information? It is one way. You see an arrow here, and it's not a bidirectional arrow. Information always flows from dendrite to cell body into an axon and then down the axon to this axon terminus right here. And it doesn't flow backwards. All right, so that's just some dogma that I'm telling you. You might have to modify that a little bit as time goes on, but that's a good place to start. So this is what we call a multipolar neuron. I don't know if you recognize that from anatomy, but it has numerous small dendrites and one really long axon. This is really good for something we call an interneuron or a motor neuron. All right. Here is another kind of neuron over here where we have the cell body and we have two long processes coming from this single projection coming out. So this is what we call a unipolar or a pseudo-unipolar. We find this kind of neuron it's an afferent neuron. So this one here is efferent, right, because it's a motor neuron. This one is an afferent. So this one is bringing signals into the central nervous system. So it is instead of afferent, what could we call it? Sensory. Sensory and afferent are exactly the same term. So these are the dendrites, right? These are the receiving ends of the neuron, and it comes up this process, and then it flows into this process over here. It enters the central nervous system, and I can see some little swellings right here. That means that this is an axon terminus like we see on this multipolar neuron over here. That's what stores neurotransmitters that will be released to communicate with another cell that's nearby. All right, so this process of a pseudo-unipolar neuron is going to be in the peripheral part of your body. This is the part that enters the central nervous system. And so this is what we call the central process, right? Central process because it's found in the central nervous system. This is the peripheral process because it's found in the peripheral nervous system. That's how those terms were coined for this particular neuron. All right, a bunch of other definitions. Groups of nerve cell bodies. and dendrites. Okay, there's something different about nerve cell bodies and dendrites compared to axons that we see on this slide right here. What is that? I couldn't quite hear you. Nerve cell bodies and dendrites are not myelinated. But what about axons? On this figure here, they're definitely... Oh, I know what I didn't do. Okay, they're myelinated, so they have a different appearance. Right, myelinated parts of neurons look white. Right, so typically we consider that white matter or myelinated. Nerve cell bodies and dendrites don't have myelin, so when you have thousands of them grouped together, their appearance is what? They're going to be gray. Right, so gray matter, especially in the central nervous system, okay, is made up of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and when there's a grouping of them, we call that a nucleus. A group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, which looks gray, is a nucleus, which is a special processing center inside the central nervous system. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to work on my cursor here. Oh, no, I didn't want to end. Wrong button. What did I want to do? I want to do pointer, arrow. Okay, I won't have to wiggle the cursor around so much. Okay, but you could also have a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system someplace with a bunch of synapses between them. That's not called a nucleus, that's called a ganglion, right? So ganglia would be plural. There's a misnomer that runs around in a lot of books because some new nucleus is kind of a new terminology. Sometimes books refer to a number of nuclei inside the brain as the basal ganglia. Maybe you've heard of basal ganglia, like the putamen and caudate nucleus and things like that. And that's kind of a misnomer because where do you find ganglia? By the modern definition, ganglia is in the peripheral nervous system, not the brain. So in your language, I don't know how our book calls it, if we're talking about basal areas in the brain that are gray, we should call them basal nuclei, even though your book might call them basal ganglia. That's really kind of an archaic terminology. Okay? All right, so we talked about axons and dendrites. What's the function of a dendrite? Is to
receive,
collect information. Axons then transmit that information, and this axon hillock integrates the information up and makes a decision and finds out if it's important to transmit that information on to other cells. So it makes a decision. So that's pretty interesting that even a single cell can integrate and make decisions for you. All right, so axons are long, all right, and there's a couple transport mechanisms in an axon for bulk material. There is axoplasmic flow and axonal transport. Axoplasmic flow moves soluble components toward nerve endings, which is the axon terminus, via rhythmic contractions of the axon. Think of it as maybe like peristalsis, right? And it's just kind of squeezing material down the length of an axon, and it's relatively slow compared to a nerve impulse. It's really, really slow, right? But at least it can move material down from one part of the cell to another. The other is axonal transport. And axonal transport requires microtubules. All right, and don't forget, one thing that you learned about microtubules is that it's like, what, a little monorail system inside the cell. It can position organelles. It can push and pull on the membrane and give the membrane a certain kind of shape, so cells have different shapes. All right, but so axonal transport moves large and insoluble compounds either toward the axon terminus or even the other way from the axon terminus into the cell body by hopping rides on microtubules. But you need little motors to do that. All right, so antegrade transport moves materials away from the cell body. Antegrade means in the way that you should be thinking in a forward direction. All right, so if you're going the correct direction down a one-way street, that's you're moving in an antegrade fashion, right, in the correct direction. All right, so food moves from your mouth to anus in an antegrade direction. Blood moves from your heart down into a capillary via an antegrade kind of motion. Right, retrograde means what? Backwards. Don't say backwards. Always just say retrograde. Sometimes you do have retrograde flow of blood from an artery back into the heart, okay, or from a small artery back into a large artery. That does happen. That's retrograde motion. I won't give you any digestive examples of retrograde motion, but I bet you could think of some. Or maybe over the weekend, hopefully you won't, but maybe you will, okay? Okay, retrograde moves materials in terms of a neuron, what, from the ends, or from the cell, retrograde from the ends toward the cell body, like from the axon terminus back into the cell body. All right, different kinds of motor proteins are needed for antegrade and retrograde transport. It still needs microtubules, but kinesin molecules are for antegrade transport, and dynein molecules or little motor proteins are used for retrograde transport. And as a matter of fact, some viruses have figured out how to hop a ride on these dynein proteins, motor proteins, and actually move from the periphery of your body, where? To the central nervous system that way, okay, which is kind of a nasty little trick. And some toxins enter the central nervous system that way as well. All right, so that's an interesting area of research to try to protect people from viral infections is by inhibiting these dynein proteins. All right, so that is mass transport. All right, some functional classification. We talked a little bit, some functional classifications of neurons. Basically, you have three kinds of neurons. I see two different kinds of neurons on this slide. Let me just go to the next one real quick. Oh, there it is right there. Okay, well, let's start with this slide. We got two major locations. This blue area is central nervous system, so that's brain and spinal cord. And this area over here, which is a little bit darker, that's out in the periphery someplace. What color is that right there?
Green.
Green. Okay, we got blue and green. And we see a nice multipolar neuron. And here is what that pseudo-unipolar. We said pseudo-unipolar is always an afferent neuron. Here clearly you can see the peripheral process, and here clearly the central process of this bipolar neuron. Here's a nice motor neuron, and it is what, a multipolar neuron. It starts, it has a cell body in the central nervous system, and then it leaves. Oh, does anybody remember, how does it leave? It leaves via root. What kind of root? The ventral root of the spinal cord goes to the periphery. You might have to go back and review some of your anatomy over the weekend. Okay, and then this one right here. So this is going to a skeletal muscle. So this is what we call a somatic motor neuron. So would you say this is voluntary or involuntary? That's a voluntary pathway, right? Because skeletal muscles are really the only things that you have control of in your body voluntarily. Nothing else. Everything else in your body is controlled automatically via what? The autonomic nervous system. So here's a typical outflow pathway for autonomic system. As a matter of fact, you should know, what about the autonomic nervous system? How many divisions are there? There are two, and they're called the sympathetic and parasympathetic. It always has two neurons back to back, right? If it's an autonomic outflow pathway. The first cell body is in the central nervous system. It moves into the peripheral nervous system where there is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system?
Ganglion.
A ganglion. And it's labeled right here. So here's an autonomic ganglia. For sympathetic and parasympathetic, review where they're located. They're different for parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. Different neurotransmitters are going to be used, so we're going to talk about that. Right, but for an autonomic pathway, you've got two. You've got a ganglion someplace before it gets to an effector organ. So here's the preganglionic fiber. Here is the postganglionic fiber. And then the postganglionic fiber is going to stimulate some effector organs. What are three classes of effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? How about skeletal muscle? Not skeletal muscle. Okay, what would it be for autonomic nervous system? What don't you have control of? Your heart, so cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands, right, are the effectors for the autonomic nervous system. Okay, what I don't see on this slide right here is an interneuron. An interneuron is a multipolar neuron right here. Okay, on the next slide I'll show you. So don't forget, here is an afferent neuron. Afferent is bringing signals from the periphery into the central nervous system. And this is an example of a motor neuron because it's taking signals away from the central nervous system to the periphery. And this is a motor pathway too, because which way are signals moving? From CNS into the periphery. And of course, these neurons only carry information how many ways? Only one way, right? That's the way it goes. Now, a neuron carries information one way, but a nerve might have both of these kinds of fibers in there. So a nerve is bidirectional, but a single cell is only one direction. All right, so on the next slide right here, we see the different kinds of neurons. We got multipolar, which can be what? Motor. Here is pseudo-unipolar, which is sensory. And as a matter of fact, let's look at this multipolar. It can also be an interneuron. If it's an interneuron, sorry, you don't have a picture of this. At least I don't see it here. An interneuron is a multipolar neuron that is found completely within the central nervous system. It doesn't have an axon that leaves. It has a cell body and dendrites in the central nervous system, and then it sends that information only within the central nervous system, so it's called an association neuron, or what? An interneuron. They're completely within the CNS. All right, so that's... So multipolar neurons can be motor or interneurons. Pseudo-unipolar are sensory, and bipolar, you don't have a whole lot of, they're for special senses, like for olfaction and vision and things like that. So they're a special sensory neuron for special senses. We'll look at that a little bit later in the class. So bipolar have a similar kind of function to pseudo-unipolar. Okay, so I do want you to know these by their cell shape. All right, what their function is. If I show you the shape of this one, you should know its function on the test. Or this one, the shape of a bipolar, you should know its function, right? So that's good to know. All right, so let's talk a little bit about support cells before we quit for today. One kind of support cell, which we've looked at already, we see wrapping around an axon of, what kind of neuron is this right here? It's a multipolar, right? So this would be an example of a nice motor neuron, maybe, or an association neuron. What's another name for motor? Whoever tells me first can get make pretend extra credit point. Is what? Is efferent. Effector. It's going to affect something. Efferent. Very good. Okay. So it's efferent. So signals are going to start in the central nervous system, move out to the periphery. Now, I see another color type cell right here, which looks kind of, let's say gray. Okay? And it is a Schwann cell. And the Schwann cell wraps itself around an axon, and it changes the electrical properties of this axon right here. Okay? And it actually forms a layer of insulation around the axon so that nerve impulses travel very fast compared to an axon that is not myelinated. That insulating material is a lipid that we call myelin, and it's made by a Schwann cell. So here's a Schwann cell that wraps itself around. These inner layers only contain that lipid, which is myelin. The rest of the cytoplasm is kind of pushed to the external layers of a Schwann cell, and so sometimes we call that the neurolemma. The neurolemma is just the cytoplasm of a Schwann cell that's wrapped around the outside right here, right? The inner layers are what make the myelin sheath that insulate this axon right here. Now, the wires in your house, most of them, do they have insulation around them or not? Oh, they absolutely do. Like the plug on your toaster. Would you unplug it from the wall if it didn't have insulation on them? You do that, okay, just for fun, to wake up in the morning. Otherwise, you don't, right? Okay, so this myelin keeps the electrical properties inside the axon. That's a good just way to start to think about it. So this axon is in the peripheral nervous system. We call that a Schwann cell. Right? So Schwann cells are in the peripheral nervous system along with satellite cells. Satellite cells do not wrap insulation around axons. They do other things, and I don't have a picture for you. But let's go back. What kind of cell is this right here? That's a pseudo-unipolar. What's its function? It's sensory, right, or afferent. All right, so this cell body is located in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so we're thinking peripheral nervous system. There's a group of these located someplace. So what do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? A ganglion, and where they're located is in the dorsal root, right? That's the root for the spinal cord where signals enter, because we said, what? This is a sensory neuron. So the dorsal root ganglion has, maybe hundreds of thousands of these things, right? That's why there's a little bulge in the dorsal root. We call that the dorsal root ganglia, so it makes sense. And what's separating all of these nerve cell bodies are neuroglia cells that we call satellite cells. So they surround the cell body of each of those neurons that are entering the central nervous system, and they're called satellite cells. probably because somebody that saw that underneath the microscope was also building telescopes hundreds of years ago. And when you look up and you see Jupiter, what do you see around Jupiter? Like little dots surrounding it, the moons of Jupiter. And they go, oh, well, those cells that I see underneath the microscope remind me of Jupiter with those satellites around it. So I'm going to call those satellite cells, right? But they help maintain the health of this nice pseudo-unipolar neuron. So those are the two kinds of peripheral system cells. You've got Schwann cells, which wrap myelin around the axon, and then satellite cells that surround the cell bodies of all those pseudo-unipolar neurons. Only two kinds. And what's the function of these Schwann cells right here? They, for right now, you have to know, they speed up the rate of impulse conduction down an axon. So a myelinated axon can transmit information very fast compared to a non-myelinated axon. That's the job. Okay, that's one of the jobs. All right, so that's peripheral nervous system. Let's switch to central nervous system. Here are a number of cells in the central nervous system, and I think I can just point these out to you, and that might be about it. All right, here we see some cells that are wrapping themselves around an axon of a neuron. Here's a nice multipolar neuron. All right, so this again is a myelin sheath, but this is in the central nervous system. It's made by a different kind of cell. In the PNS, it is a Schwann cell. In the central nervous system, it is an oligodendrocyte. So oligodendrocytes make myelin sheaths in the central nervous system. The other thing you notice is that oligodendrocytes have multiple processes. They can form a myelin sheath at multiple locations on an axon, but also multiple neurons as well. A little bit more complicated. All right, so oligodendrocytes have different behavior compared to Schwann cells. Maybe I'll talk about why that is a little bit. It has to do with regeneration. Central nervous system, when this neuron in the central nervous system is injured or is damaged, all right, the repair is very poor. You all know that spinal cord injuries are pretty much permanent because these oligodendrocytes prevent regeneration. But in the peripheral nervous system, you've probably heard of people getting hand transplants or finger transplants after they or having their finger reattached to their body, and they actually can regain use of their digits and hand. And that's because the Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system actually promote regeneration of nerves going to effector organs. So that's because there's two different kinds of cells that do that. So here is an oligodendrocyte. Here we have a microglia cell or microglial cell. This is an immune cell, so that protects your body from infection, from cancers and things like that, right? Kind of can crawl around inside your brain looking for things that don't belong there. If they have the wrong antigens, where do you find antigens? Anybody remember where you have antigens? Where are they located? On the plasma membrane of all cells have antigens, right? That define that those cells belong to your body. And if they don't belong there, these microglia cells then will develop a defense or attack them. And then we have astrocytes. Astrocytes, you can see, have processes that attach to neurons, but it also has processes that attach to blood vessels right here. So one function is that it can take things from blood and directly deliver it to a neuron. So it can be a door-to-door transport of important molecules. Could you give me an example of one important molecule maybe this neuron needs to make ATP? How about oxygen? Oxygen can diffuse pretty easily. But there's one molecule that has a little bit of difficulty moving through cell membranes, and that is glucose. Yeah, so astrocytes can take glucose from the blood and directly feed this neuron right here. That's a pretty nice function, because what happens if you don't have glucose in your brain? What did I say? I said you get dingy, right? Drive on the wrong side of the road, that kind of thing. The last cell that we're going to talk about next time are these ependymal cells, and they form a barrier between the cerebrospinal fluid and the brain proper. All right, so next time we're going to start with this slide once again, and I want you to make sure you can recognize these cells by shape, but also know them by function. Okay? Okay. So there's probably a blank sign-in sheet going around someplace too. Yeah, and it's upstairs, and it's going to come down. And I want to talk to some people after class, please. I'm not familiar with it.
It's active
diet?
It's like Atkins.
Oh, it's like Atkins.
Yeah.
But
I did it during the semester in school, and I couldn't come.
Oh, yeah. You get what? Dinghy.
Yeah,
you just get dinghy. Thank you so much. Good.
I told you I'd bring you that from when I wasn't here.
Okay.
My doctor's now.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So what did you miss? What kind of online stuff did you miss, or quizzes,
didn't
or tests?
I miss anything online. The thing I missed was the lab quiz.
One lab quiz?
Yeah.
Okay. I think maybe you might be able to make that up with like extra credit and stuff like that, but I tell you what, who's your instructor? Maybe put your lab instructor down on there too.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, thank you for the letter. Thank you.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good. All right. Let me turn the projectors off because I'm going to look you up online. Video mute. Yeah. I'm sure your lab instructor knows what lab you're in, but just
thank
in
you.
Case. Okay.
There you go.
Okay, good. Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. The weekly modules you can access it, but the quiz you cannot access. It goes away.
Okay.
Every week like clockwork.
No, if I did the quiz,
on Tuesday. Wednesday. It goes away on Wednesday. I don't think so. Only if the deadline hasn't passed. So there might be still a couple weeks before the next test. You can still access those in the future, but not any in the past that have gone away. You can still get them? You can still take them? Maybe I'll check. It's not supposed to do that. I think I have it programmed properly, but maybe not. Oh, I don't want to project this, but I want to see the screen. How about if I say off? Mute. Oh, good. I still see it. Okay. Mia, I need to know what section you're in. Do you know your CRN number by any chance?
CRN?
Yeah. I'm not showing that, right? Good. I have sign-in sheet. I have it hidden. I'll break them out in just a second. Blackboard.
I don't know. I guess I'll just...
No, hold on. Maybe I can find out. Let me get in here.
Is it like 22232?
Something like that. Yeah.
Then I think that's it.
Okay. This keyboard doesn't tell me if I have caps lock on or not. And passwords are case sensitive. Ah, good, okay, I got in. So sometimes it takes me a couple of tries. All right, so this is physiology, like 22232. All right, let's try that one first. Ah, good going. Okay. So, what do I got to say? For Bio 241, that's what I'm important for, right? 241. So, we got attitude, number of punctuality, grade to date, instructor signature. Okay. And what do I know? I know your grade to date that's in here, right? Okay, some of these other things I don't know. How many times are you absent?
I haven't been yet.
Very good. Okay. comments?
You don't have to do that.
I don't? Okay. So what is this for? Ah, this is for basketball. Okay. 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 I signed it.
Thank you.
Maybe I'll put the date. Okay, you're welcome.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So four carbon fatty acid.
A four? Four carbon fatty acid?
Did it only go through Krebs cycle one time?
It only goes through beta oxidation one time.
Okay.
And it can go through Krebs cycle twice.
But
you get some FADH and NADH for beta oxidation, but since it can only go through one time, it only gets one FADH and one NAD.
Okay,
it only gets split apart one time.
So 16 carbons can go through seven times, right?
Yeah. Because it goes through seven times, and then when it goes through the very last time, it's a four carbon. Okay, and when it gets split that very last time, you end up with two carbon fragments, not just one. And since you got a two carbon fragment, that last two carbon fragment doesn't have to go through beta oxidation because it's already two carbons.
And that's gonna go through.
Doesn't have to go through beta oxidation. That can go right into Krebs cycle directly.
Go
it goes directly into Krebs cycle. So you still get all the ATP from Krebs, but you don't get the ATP from
beta oxidation.
That's it.
Back to Atkins diet. You have all this triglyceride.
So triglycerides in your body, yeah.
Yeah, so they eventually convert back to acetyl-CoA, right? I mean,
absolutely.
So
triglycerides are being broken down by lipase. You got a lot of fatty acids, all right? And then fatty acids are broken down.
Okay.
And you've got, it's producing some NADH and FADH, so you can make some ATP from that.
So what does it do to the Krebs cycle to get shut down?
Because all the Krebs cycle intermediates are large carbon molecules, like 4, 5, 6, and you can only get those kind of carbons from sugars.
Oh, okay.
So you have to have sugars in your diet in order to have the intermediates for the Krebs cycle.
I see. But the acetyl-CoA, does that still go into the... Oh, it is in the mitochondria.
Yeah, it's in the mitochondria, but it can't be broken down to CO2 because Krebs cycle isn't working. So your body is struggling to do with all something to do with all those two carbon fragments. It starts to put them together and make ketone bodies out of it, which are very volatile compounds. Yeah, ketones are volatile compounds. You just breathe all of that energy right out of your body, right? Like as acetone and other ketone bodies, which have a characteristic kind of aroma to them.
Acetone, is that like three carbon?
It's a three carbon.
Three carbon,
yeah.
Acetyl-CoA can make...
Now, that's a pretty good question because of the level of oxidation of it, yeah.
Great,
yeah.
Thank you so
okay.
Much.
Can I have the syringe?
Yeah. Anywhere on there. And then we want to look at a test.
Yes.
Good. That's fine with me.
You don't have a class after
this? I do not.
Thank you.